This is Tony Gosling's Weekly Politics Show, live from Bristol, on BCFM and the International Community Radio Network.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. They want you to forget, but we want you to remember. So, helping us review this week's news is Ashley Ward candidate for the recent local elections, Dave Dobbs, who is standing for the birthday party, was also a candidate for Bristol Mayor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to attack Syria and Iran. So he visits Moscow. But as new Russian fleet sails into the Mediterranean, he gets a cool response from President Vladimir Putin. And 3 weeks to go until the not-so-secret as they used to be, NATO Mafia Bilderberg Club. They have their annual Slime Fest. This year they bless us with holding it on British soil. The protest festival outside is already being organised. They don't appear on the university curriculum, but they control most of the money in the Western world. Yes, the Bilderberg Club, founded by a Nazi SS officer. But what's the latest on their links to fascism, war and organised crime? And doing something about First Bus's virtual stranglehold on our need to get to and from work every day. To many, it feels like a racket. So, can suburban railways and bus rapid transit do the trick? Judy Boston joins us, who's been one of the prime movers in public transport in Bristol, helping us to get more frequent services on the Severn Beach line. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. I ought to start by apologising for last week's forecast, where we said it was going to be sunny with no rain last Sunday, which, of course, it wasn't. It was a little bit rainy, but let's see if the Weather Outlook can do a little bit better this week. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and some light rain. Highs this weekend of around 13, generally cloudy, with some sunny spells, showers on Sunday. Highs next week, around 20 degrees Celsius, a fairly sunny and warm week. Next weekend's the 25th and 26th of May, highs of 16, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com, and you might have noticed it was a little bit vaguer than last week's. Anyway, helping us review this week's news is Ashley Ward candidate in the recent local elections, Dave Dobbs, who is also standing for Mayor of Bristol for the birthday party. Hi, Dave, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hey, hi Tony, how you doing?
Nice to see you. Now, first of all, the birthday party, what is it?
It's a political party. It's a genuine, registered with the House of Commons political party, which costs £150 to register, takes only two people to make to register a political party. You've got to share a few posts if you want to sort of keep it down to two people. I mean, that's how many we've got in there officially in the birthday party.
Okay, so it's you and who?
Me and my good friend John Balash, who's the treasurer. I've got to say, we've never actually had one single donation. I don't think we've even had a pound. Not that we've really tried to put out.
Have you been chatting to big businesses, KPMG, people like that, saying, look, you know, we can do what it takes for you as a political party?
As of the moment, I've got to be honest with you, I haven't. We've never knocked on any doors. I don't really believe in any other sort of door knocking. You know, what it's really about is just getting involved, really. And not to, you know, if you're not in it to win it, but you're in it for the fact that you've got something to say and that you can stand on the same podiums as all of those politicians can say, and when they say what they're going to say and you know it's absolute lies, you can actually put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, so the idea is that you're there to counter some of the lies you think that the mainstream party politicians are coming out with. What sort of things?
Well, just what sort of things? It's just the whole thing is, you know, the whole kind of every stage of what I hear come out of most politicians' mouth is just absolute, you know, from start to finish. I just couldn't really sort of like, but I mean,
what about you know, say for example, the management of the economy. Would you have something to say about that?
Masses to say about that.
Go on then.
Well, I mean, it's You know, I've written a book called Laughing Gas, and one of the reasons I was doing this is to try and promote the book, and the book's very much about the actual, the structure of the financial, sort of like the financial world, and how the banks have been completely and utterly just, I mean, the banks are like private people that are just basically taking all this money. They've got their, they've got some kind of, they've got this kind of claim and this right to sort of like to take the money from the government and basically not lend it out. And it seems that the politicians are in collusion with the banks, and the banks seem to be in collusion with sort of like with anyone who wants to start up a war. And very little money seems to be coming from the banks and being lent to the people where it's really needed to sort of like do the things that they want to do, and to make this world, to make this country at least, and to the world at large, run properly. And it's and we're all seeing the same thing. I've never seen so many people that have studied, you know, ever since Zeitgeist came out and we started understanding terms like fractional reserve banking.
This is an internet film, wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah, it was an amazing film, actually. Zeitgeist is, and the probably what's trumped Zeitgeist as of lately is Thrive, which is also an amazing video, which is follows in a very similar sort of foot as Zeitgeist, which really sort of takes you through the sort of like the flaws of fractional reserve banking.
I mean, for a lot of people, I think they'll say, you know, a lot of this stuff to do with the economy is we'd really rather someone else dealt with it. And a lot of it seems like jargonistic, very difficult to actually get to the bottom of. But you've just talked about fractional reserve banking. That's one very fundamental thing to understand about the way banks operate. What is it?
Well, it's understanding that a long time ago, in the just by the end of the 60s, we were sort of like, there was so much debt in, the US dollar was in so much debt that France was asking for all its money back in gold. And that's when a new situation, because of all the debt, there needed to be some kind of resolution where everyone gets paid back, or they just make the hole a lot bigger. And the option that the American government went for, along with the British government, we only remember it probably as decimalization when we had a big change in our economy in the early 70s. But what we saw was that basically, instead of having all the value of the US dollars tagged to a volume of gold, suddenly the value of the US dollar was tagged to the movement of cash. Not anyone, not like the banker's cash or the government's cash, but the movement of all cash. So it's once you've got the movement of the whole global financial system going through the US dollar, and then it's being timesed by 10, if not more, it's just free money. The bankers are getting free money. And when you've got free money in a situation like this, and they're printing off money at such stupid volumes, and it's not actually going to the people, then you've just got a complete robbery of wealth. It's just a complete vacuum, a black hole of just of.
But getting back to this term, fractional reserve, Dave, what I understand it to mean anyway, maybe Martin can educate me if I get it all wrong, is that actually the banks only keep a very, very tiny amount of the money that they've actually lent out in deposits themselves. So what we're saying is that they're basically making money up out of nowhere and lending it out at interest. And it's, you know, because of that, if everybody came to get their money from the bank at the same time, there's no way they could all do it, because this money is actually fictional money that's being made up. I mean, we like to think of money as there being a finite quantity of it, but basically the banks have a license to make this stuff up out of thin air and then lend it out at interest, and that money's lent into the economy as debt. So that's what they, when they say fractional reserve, that there's only a fraction of the money that is actually out there the banks actually really ever held in the first place. So most of the money that's out there is this kind of fictional stuff that's been created by a magic wand. Someone's made a magic wand, pressed a key on a computer, and suddenly it's appeared in a bank account.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with everything you say there. The only thing I would say to add to that is that it's kind of, most people will accept that as a viable system all the time the banks are lending money to them. But once the actual money, once they've actually start, you know, the quantitative easing is when we actually start lending money over and above the quantitative easing bracket, when there's not enough movement to generate the type of money the governments want to spend, so they start printing off more than the official sort of like quotas that they can run with fractional reserve banking. So that really means that they start stealing the money out of people's bank accounts. They start printing off more than is ever feasible. They just start pumping money out, and it starts devaluing and devaluing and devaluing all the currency around, and it starts pushing prices up. Inflation goes crazy. We're all just getting robbed on every level, and it's our consent in this that's got to be looked at and understood. And the only real way we're going to get around this is all of us really starting to understand on a very finite level how this works.
Well, I like your exposition of all this, Dave. Martin, can you just explain? It seems that Dave's saying here, and I would probably agree with him, that the banks are setting the rules of the game. The politicians are supposed to be, but they're not setting the rules of the game anymore. The banks are, and the politicians have been bought by these bankers.
Yeah, I think you've got to distinguish between fractional reserve banking, which has been around as long as banks have been around, although, in fact, the fractional focus of this is, I mean, that banks are leveraged much higher than they used to be. In the era before 1971, they had to keep a proportion of their assets back.
Okay, when you say leveraged, what you mean is this is the proportion that they're actually lending out that they don't have compared to what they actually do have.
You've now, what happened in 1971 was that the dollar was linked to gold in the Bretton Woods system, and because they couldn't afford to fight the Vietnam War, they decided, we'll get rid of that and we'll just start printing money. And so you've then got fiat, what they call fiat currencies then. There's nothing backing it. There's no gold backing
it. I mean, it's almost, isn't it like counterfeiting? Yeah. Isn't it like them having a couple of plates to make pound notes? And
I think this is, people are beginning to be aware of how important all of this is, but I think it is important to try and be as precise as possible when we're unpicking it. What they do is they say, you don't really understand all of this. You're confusing one thing with another. People know, if they've got any sense at all, they can smell a rat now. It's quite obvious that the people running the financial sector either A, didn't know what they're doing, or do know what they're doing and they shouldn't be doing it. And I think that what we need to do, it's not just a fringe thing. I mean, there's an organisation called Positive Money, which you may have come across, which is campaigning against fractional reserve banking, and they're trying to lobby all the decision makers to say, well, why doesn't the government just provide the money that it's required to run the economy? Why contract that to the private sector banks, who are in any case bankrupt?
Yeah, well, why don't they?
Well, because basically the private sector banks have got too much political power. But when they were bailed out in 2008, they were rescued from themselves, and instead of changing their behaviour, they said, oh goody, we can now carry on much as we did before. In fact, the derivatives market is now bigger as a bubble than it was then. And of course, all that means really in the end is it's going to crash, because of course all this funny money eventually is just funny money, and when it crashes, people suddenly realise that it's not really there.
Thanks, Martin, for explaining that. Now, let's have a look at the political parties. Dave, what's your thoughts on the main parties, the Conservatives, Lib Dem and Labour?
I think they're going down. I think people, it's just the, I think they're going to, you know, they're so last century, and I just think we've got to accept that, you know, they've got their place, but... You know, we've seen what happened at sort of like when Tony Blair sort of like turned the whole kind of, he created new Labour when he turned the whole Labour Party upside down, and suddenly instead of having sort of like everyone on the top disseminating the information down to the leader, and the leader represents the masses, when he turned it upside down and he made the sort of like the top henchmen sort of like in control, and everyone had to sort of like jump when they were told to jump. It was the end of what Labour was. You know, that's not to say that, because I speak to many people that are members of the Labour Party, actually, and they still stand for the good old fashioned sort of like rules and what Labour was about, which was, you know, fair rights, and sort of like it was the fact that it was everyone, and everyone was in there, everyone had a voice, and that doesn't exist in the Labour Party anymore, as was demonstrated after the when the Labour councillors tried to join George Ferguson's cabinet.
Martin.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. I mean, you've got to remember why the Labour Party went for that kind of top-down structure. If you think back to the 70s and earlier, there's always been a left wing and a right wing in the Labour Party, like two twins. And there was a lot of rowing and arguing, and of course the rowing and arguing, the conservative media, and the media is generally conservative, would pick up on that and say, well, look, they're rowing and arguing, they can't agree amongst themselves, don't vote for them. And so there was a kind of pressure even from the left of the party, which I'd include myself, that we've got to look more professional if we're going to win, you know, that we've got to try and beat these people at their own game. So that was the idea behind it. But of course what happened with Tony Blair when he took us to war with Iraq is he caused a great deal of anger at the grassroots of the Labour Party, because that's our reputation as a party that's against war and against imperialism being shredded.
Well, I just want to bring very upset about just that. Want to bring you guys up to date, because we've just had an announcement today that George Ferguson has announced his new cabinet, and Labour councillors Mark Bradshaw and Brenda Massey have joined the mayor's rainbow cabinet, as they call it, and taking on two of the toughest briefs in the city. That's Chris Brown writing on Bristol247.com. So, you know, we've had this debacle since the mayoral elections, but now Labour are in there, Martin.
Well, I mean, that's the first I've heard of it. I mean, as I said on the programme, this programme last week, it's up to those who are making the decision to decide whether to go into the cabinet or not. The fact of the matter is that central government cuts are coming to Bristol, whoever's in the cabinet, whoever's the mayor, and whether we had a mayor or not. The policy has already been decided at central government level, and really we're just talking about what people are going to administer the cuts at local level. And even if Labour had won the mayoral election, we would have still been in the same position of having everything cut by central government. Ultimately, we've got to change the central government in Britain to something that's actually concerned about the people. But then, of course, you're going to run up against things like the Pentagon and Wall Street, and these people don't play fair.
Just to go through the run-up of the cabinet that's been announced today, Councillor Mark Bradshaw, Labour, is doing transport planning, strategic housing and regeneration. One of the city slackers, who doesn't like coming on this programme, obviously because he's got more important things to do, that's Councillor Simon Cook. He's a Lib Dem, who won by, I think it was just 14 votes at the local election earlier this month. He's doing leisure, tourism, licensing and community safety. Councillor Jeff Gollop, Conservative, is doing finance and corporate services. And Gus Hoyt, the Green Party councillor, he's doing neighbourhoods, environment and council housing. Councillor Barbara Jank, the Lib Dems, health and social care, and Brenda Massey for Labour is doing children, young people and education. Dave, the Labour are in the cabinet here in the city now. Do you think that's a good thing? Or doesn't it matter?
I think what's quite fascinating is, I mean, I wasn't too sure about George, but I'm a great believer that sort of like the proof comes in the pudding. You know, we'll see. I think he's a really nice bloke, actually, and I think having someone who's got Bristol at heart rather than sort of like another agenda or another political party, he seems to have Bristol at heart. And I think that is, if he's reffing, sort of as it were, refereeing between all of these different sort of like candidates, and all the, you know, I think we might end up with sort of like some quite interesting decisions rather than. You know, I think he's a nice bloke, and I think ultimately it's who's the actual ref in this, and George Ferguson is playing more of a referee, I think.
Martin, it seems that you're
days are numbered. I don't think he's going to be a referee. I'm afraid he's basically a king with an advisory council.
Well,
and that was the argument against Labour going in, because there's no actual decision-making power. Well, he will decide.
We were saying last week with Peter Abraham, weren't we? Dictatorship, basically. That's what people voted for when they voted for a mayor.
In the rest of the country, people will find it very strange that we've now got an independent mayor who's got all the political parties in his cabinet, and that's Bristol for you. We're a bit strange, aren't we? We're a bit odd. And I think George Ferguson tapped into that kind of sense in Bristol that we want to do things differently here. But I'm afraid the problem is that the national and international financial situation is dire, drastically dire. And if we're not in a position of deciding how to spend more on nice things, we're going to be deciding who gets cut. And of course, all that happens there is we're all going to have to put our hands on the knife and take responsibility for cutting whatever it is going to be cut.
Now,
and then we'll all get covered
in blood.
This
whole business about how decisions are made in the cabinet now, with Labour in there, because Labour were insisting that they wanted voting rights, let's just have a look at how it's been sorted out. Labour's demand for voting rights, says Chris Brown on Bristol247.com, in cabinet over mayor's decisions has been agreed. The mayor will still have overall decision-making powers, meaning he can override the wishes of a majority in cabinet any time he likes. So really,
constitutional monarchy.
Is that what it is? Constitutional monarchy.
When I was running, I was actually born. I was born in Lewes, and I was actually born on what was the battlefield.
Lewes. This is in Sussex.
Yeah, that's just outside of Brighton in Sussex, and it's where we actually, in 1264, there were two kings, King of England, Henry the...
I think you're thinking of the revolt of the barons, aren't you? Simon de Montfort,
absolutely.
He was
right,
not a king.
No, he was a parliamentarian, wasn't he? He was a parliamentarian, but he came and he... It was Henry the Third. He was down at Lewes Castle, and Lewes Castle was the first Norman armory built after William conquered Harold. And in 1264, after Henry III decided he was going to rip apart the Magna Carta and thought it was a load of old rubbish, and he actually believed that no one actually at that time really understood, or perhaps they did, but no one really understood at that time that the common law was actually a rule book for the kings. It was to keep, to stop the kings doing so much reckless killing. It was to try and keep them in line. And when they ripped it up, it was the King of England and his brother, the King of Germany. They were walled up in the sort of like in the safe haven of the Lewis Castle, and Simon de Montfort came down with half of London and took them both alive. And rather than killing them, he held them at knife point and got all the gold off the King of Germany, Henry III's brother, and off Henry III, who was quite broke at the time. He got basically the country. He divided the country up into all what we now understand as the local our local elections wars, our boroughs, and that's how we originally sort of like fought for our local elections, fought to decentralise.
But it's all becoming much more re-centralised now, isn't it?
It is, and it's a tragic shame, because it's really...
And in fact, not even just re-centralised to Westminster, re-centralised to Brussels.
To Washington, mate. Wall Street.
Yeah.
That's where the real decisions are made.
Okay, well, we've had a little chat about the political parties. Martin, you know, Dave here is really trying to challenge the system, this political party system, which you yourself have said is virtually controlled and owned by the city. So isn't he doing the right thing by trying to break up these break the mould, as in a way the city has done by voting for George?
Well, I mean, he's exercising his democratic rights as a citizen, and people need to know what they are, and they also need to know the history of where they came from, and therefore they'd value them more if they knew that history. I'm a member of the Labour Party more in hope than in expectation, because ultimately I see the Labour Party as potentially the only force which is big enough to take on things like the City of London. Now, that may sound as if I'm being rather, hopeful there, but I mean, ultimately, the other side see the Labour Party as the potential threat. That's why they parachute people like Tony Blair in on us, to make sure that we behave ourselves. But I mean, that's the struggle. And if you think back to how people used to struggle against the communist system in Eastern Europe, in Poland, for example, which I know a lot about because I used to live over there, a lot of people would join the Communist Party, even though it was not democratic, as a means of trying to leverage change. And I would say I'm a member of the Labour Party now in that same sort of spirit.
I mean, aren't there quite a lot of people that join political parties just to get a piece of the pie? I mean, maybe to get a nice job. A nice job after they finish being an MP or a councillor.
Some do. It's true. But I actually think, but for me, what I get out of the local election campaigns, and I've done quite a lot of campaigning in Bristol, is going and knocking on the doors and talking to ordinary folk. And the Labour vote, Labour people are very loyal. Daniela said when she was on here as a green candidate for mayor, she said,
she's now
a councillor for Bishopston. She said, when I knock on a door and somebody is going to vote Labour, they don't say, I'm going to vote Labour, they say, I am Labour. My dad was Labour. My granddad was Labour. And there's a loyalty there which was cruelly misused sometimes. I think Tony Blair cruelly misused it, but people are also very, very understanding. They realise what a dirty game it is, but they're still loyal to Labour because Labour does represent all that's decent.
It's fair to say there's been a bit of blowback within the Labour Party after Blair, anyway. Okay, I'm just looking at the membership of some of these political parties. In 2012, we have... I'm going to put this question to both of you. I had a discussion with Peter Abrahams, from the leader of the Tory group, last week about the different numbers of people who have partaken in trade unions and in political parties. I'd like you both to have a guess how many times more people are members of trade unions in Britain than are of any of the main four political parties. Martin, would you like to have a hazard guess?
It must be at least 5 to 10 times more.
Dave?
I've got to say, I mean, I was quite shocked at how few actual members that some of the big political parties seem to have on Facebook and stuff like that, you know. So, and I can imagine workers' kind of unions having a lot more, because...
Let's have you guess. Come on, this is a quiz. There are 15 times more members of trade unions in Britain than of political parties. Now, in 2012, UK trade unions had roughly 8 million people as actual members. And UK political parties, about 500,000, 480,000.
Can I just make a point of order here, which is that every individual member of a trade union has a right to vote in internal Labour Party elections, and it was the trade union
that only voted. Ones that are affiliated to the Labour Party. Only ones quite a few
that's
have decided
true, that's
to
true.
Step
some,
back.
Some are not affiliated. Of those that are affiliated to the Labour Party, and it was in fact the individual votes of individual trade union members which gave Ed Miliband the leadership of the Labour Party, as opposed to his brother, much to the disgust of the City of London and the right wing of the Labour Party.
So, I mean, there's 15 times more democratic right in a trade unionist than there is in a politician, which is a bizarre, since the politicians are actually controlling things, but or at least if the banks aren't, the politicians are. But anyway, look, just looking at the Labour Party on its own, Martin, I mean, back in at its peak in 1957, there were 1 million members of the Labour Party. Now, we're right down, not sure of the actual numbers nowadays, but we're now down to about a quarter of the level of 1980. So there's been a massive fall.
What's the number, what's the actual figure?
For now, I don't know, I'm sorry. Oh, but I know is 1 million were members of the Labour Party in 1957. 1957 was the biggest peak of any political party in this country, with 1 million people. So, obviously, there were things going on in the 50s that people felt, wow, politics is working, it's doing something, and they were willing to join parties. But we're now down to the levels of a quarter of 1980. I'd just like to ask you, Martin, what do you put that down to? From 1980, people three quarters of everyone that was a member of the political party has given up and gone home.
Well, it's not just the Labour Party, it's all parties.
That's right, yeah.
Don't forget, in 1957, the Second World War was a memory, a very, very close memory. So it was literally a decade before. And, of course, people also remember that the National Health Service had been brought in during that decade. So people had very good reasons for seeing the Labour Party as a very useful thing to belong to. And don't forget, people had a different kind of social life in those days. I mean, the Conservative Party, for many years, was basically a massive marriage bureau. You know, people joined the Conservative Party to meet people of their own social level, you know, solicitors and teachers and what have you, and find marriage partners. And they used to, I mean, political parties used to run, they used to have clubs where people used to go, and there was all sorts of things that people used. What's happened is loads of things have happened since then, which give people other things to think about, other things to do. They go shopping.
Okay, I've just got the figures, Dave, before you come in there. The Labour Party is around about 190,000. Currently, actually, this is the figures for 2010. The Conservative Party 140,000, the Lib Dems 50,000 now. So they've come down, I mean, you know, one fifth of their peak now, Labour, for example. Right, Dave?
Well, I was going to say, well, you made a very interesting point about clubs, because I wouldn't consider myself a politician at all, and I've never really run to win. But the first time I got involved in politics was in Brighton. And I used to go to all the protests, and I still do go to all the protests, I guess, and every time there's some kind of protest going on, and if it's for a worthy cause, I'll invariably go along, because I think if you don't actually protest and directly get involved. Anyway, staying with that thread, that particular thread, we had a sound system in Brighton called Bob Dobbs. It was just a Bob system. We called it the Bob, but we used to put on these Bob parties, and we dragged the sound system all over the place. And suddenly the Criminal Justice Bill just came in, and it made gathering illegal. And when gathering became illegal, and we were running sort of like these illegal parties, we suddenly realised that if we registered a political party, we had the right to gather, and we had the right for our own 24-hour members-only bar. And so that's why we ran in the first place, just so we could actually have legal parties, because it gave us back everything the Criminal Justice Bill attempted to take away. And our first meeting we had at the Concord, we had Norman Cook come and play. Mm-hmm. And he came and play at our all-night meeting, and it suddenly brought life back
what you'll
system.
Find is that the Labour Party, I mean, I've got friends in the party scene that you're involved in and in the Labour Party, and they're just a different cultural, it's just a different cultural milieu. I mean, the Labour Party ought to be seen by disenfranchised people as their supporter and defender. But of course, what's frequently happened is they don't actually stand up and fight for the things that people care about. I mean, and of course, then therefore people don't care about them.
For example, exactly. The benefit cap, Martin, Labour Party walked away, didn't they? Abstained on that. Anyway, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week on this theme to ask you what you think about political parties, and particularly our political leaders of the main parties.
Which party leader do you prefer, David Cameron, Nick Clegg or Ed Miliband?
I probably need none of them, to be honest. They're all very the same. They all say to do things and then a lot of things never happen, and they all try their best, but it's never always good enough. But yeah, if I probably had to say one, it'd probably be David Cameron's, but honestly, he's done all right. He's not done too badly, so yeah.
David Cameron, because he is in a party that everyone is in the world for the benefit of themselves. He is a selfish person like most people, and he don't hide that. That's why they're conservatives. The other two are the most disgraceful kind of people. They pretend to be like the average person, but actually they are no different to David Cameron. But at least they should join the Conservative Party. That's my view. I trust David Cameron.
I think I definitely prefer Ed Miliband, although not for the reasons many people would think. He associates me with me as sort of a younger person, an academic. People see as not strong leadership qualities. I actually think it's quite a good thing for him. So I like the way he connects with the people and seems to be a reserved and cautious and temperate person. Whereas the other two party leaders are saying about all the things that have gone wrong previously and all the things they're going to do right, he's holding back and not making false promises. We've heard that time and time again with Nick Clegg. We backed him last election, and as soon as he gets into power, he has to throw everything away that he's promised. Miliband is waiting, holding his time until he knows what he can achieve, and then he's going to go through with it. So I think that's a different kind of trust.
They're all just a load of posh boys, aren't they? They're all exactly the same. They don't represent any of the normal people in our society, and frankly, I'd rather vote for none of them. I mean, they all went to Eton, they all know the same people, they all socialise in the same circles, they're completely unrepresentative of British society as a whole.
Nick Clegg has let us down, hasn't he?
Cameron.
Yeah, Cameron. Well, he's best of the bad bunch.
I mean, I've always been a Conservative all my life, but I might not be voting for anybody because I'm so fed up with them. And I mean, that is real serious for me to say that.
Give him the chance. He's going to try and renegotiate. If he comes out with reasonable terms, then it's acceptable.
Bring Maggie back in, of course.
I think they're both as bad as each other, to be honest, and I've got no interest in either one of them.
I haven't got a strong opinion of any of them either. I think they just say a lot of things which get reported which don't necessarily true and stuff, so no, not impressed by any of them.
I think they're all quite self-serving, and whoever's in there is going to make sure that their party and their beliefs are upheld, and ours come very low on the priority list, so no, I don't think it matters one bit who's in there.
Cameron, probably, just because I don't know much about politics, but he seems to fill me with most confidence, I think. And I don't like Ed Miliband, he looks like a little creep. Clegg, I don't know, I want to like him, but I feel like he's not really up there with the big boys. He doesn't inspire confidence.
Have you had enough of party politics?
It's getting a bit boring, it's quite repetitive in the press, but then bad press sells, good press doesn't.
Yes, I'd say it. Yeah, definitely, yeah. I think the media makes it worse as well. They just whip up a frenzy about something which isn't as important.
Not enough. There's not enough parties because the other two main parties have had to become like Conservative to get any real recognition.
Yes, quite frankly. Living in Bristol, independent mayor, independent police commissioner, also a woman. We live in a vibrant and wonderful city, and I think the independent streak needs to carry forward to break up the old party politics.
Oh, definitely. I think we need a rise of a party that is actually representative of the people that live in this country instead of being ruled by a political elite that don't really live in the real world.
It seems like they just give you what you want to hear, which is obviously always been what politics is about. I'd be happier to go with somebody who at least felt like they were telling me something that was the truth, even if it was not necessarily what I wanted to hear. If I felt like they were giving me some honesty, I'd probably back that, even if the other people were telling me what I wanted to hear, but I didn't necessarily believe it. Bit of honesty I'd like.
Nice to finish on that, a bit of honesty. But Martin, really not a lot of approval really for our leaders. Is there a crisis of leadership going on, all our political parties?
Well, you've got to look at the way political parties are funded. All political parties need resources. In Scandinavia, those resources come from the government, if you like, so each party gets funding according
to
its...
The taxpayer.
Yes, but of course nobody else is allowed to fund it. In the US, anybody can chuck money at the political process, and in this country we're a halfway house. Basically, politicians need resources to do what they do, and then they have to go to the people with the money in order to fund them, and then of course the people with the money want something for that money. So all politicians have got two sets of people that they've got to keep happy. One is the people who vote for them, and that's what people see. The other is the people who fund them, and that's what really matters. And of course, that is why the political parties, even the Labour Party, end up doing what the City of London wants, end up doing what Wall Street wants, end up doing what the Pentagon wants, because they ultimately are the people with the cash. And that, unfortunately, is the bottom line, which is why the ordinary folk do not get policies which are in their interests.
Mm, they're just printing off money left, right and centre. It's just free
corruption,
money.
Basically.
Yeah, totally.
As the same as we used to have an electoral system which had a minority of householders allowed to vote, and votes were blatantly bought. You were talking about the boroughs system. The boroughs used to have rotten boroughs with three voters in who would send a whole MP to Parliament and so on. I mean, we've now got a situation where the City of London, which is in fact a great, it doesn't provide anything positive for Britain. The City of London, in fact, is an absolute nightmare to have on your territory because they soak up resources and they poison the process. So ultimately, they then tell everybody what to do, and it's scary. I mean, for the Labour Party to even suggest that they're going to do something against the city is really scary.
Because they keep threatening to leave these bankers, don't they? Maybe they should just go.
Well, maybe they should just go, yeah.
One of the effects, of course, of all this is the cuts. And this, of course, drives people more and more into the hands of those with the money. One of the stories this week, night shelter benefit change could force thousands onto the streets. The benefit rule risks closure of night shelters, forcing hundreds onto the streets. This is Patrick Butler and Nigel Bunyan in The Guardian on Wednesday. Hundreds of vulnerable homeless people face being turned out onto the streets amid confusion over how local authorities should interpret a legal ruling which triggers the closure of emergency night shelters. Some shelters which rely on housing benefit payments to fund their operations could be forced to shut after a court ruled they don't legally constitute a dwelling. Dave?
Well, I mean, it's just, I've been working in the Bear Pit in Bristol. I don't know how well you know the Bear Pit, but there's a lot of homelessness in Bristol at the moment. So I'm just seeing it on a much more localised level rather than the whole country. But I've just seen it getting, it's getting pretty bad in Bristol. There's so much homelessness, and this is just another form of cuts that just seems to be as unnecessary as so many of the other cuts. Real people are just getting turfed out onto the streets. It's heartbreaking, actually. It's just,
I mean, it's really, I mean, these people are absolutely dependent, obviously, on just little bits of money. Martin, does it mean if someone is made homeless, I mean, what should they do? What are they expected to do? Just get a job?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter...
Oh, sorry, there are no jobs.
No, these are the kind of people who do not... classically, homeless people, for obvious reasons, partly because they haven't got an address, do not participate in the political process. And therefore, of course, the only way that their needs are going to be expressed is if somebody else picks up the baton for them, as it were. And, of course, we're now finding that people... We're being told to blame the poor for the fact that the wealthy have stolen all the money. And, of course, this is, of course, very pernicious. And this is really stupid as well, of course, because you will end up spending more money on these people one way or another. If you don't put them in the night shelter, they're going to be sleeping in the street, and then you're going to get upset with that about that. Okay. They're possibly going to turn to crime. You're going to need to police them or whatever. There's no... rhyme or reason. A lot of this is
I'll tell you what the rhyme and reason is. If more people you've got sleeping on the streets, it focuses the minds of everyone that's walking past them, doesn't it?
That's quite right. As Gore Vidal said about America, he said the thing about America that people have got to realise is that the wealthy can't enjoy their wealth unless the poor suffer and are seen to suffer. And I think this kind of attitude is very much at the heart of Conservative Party thinking.
Totally,
and of course, it's completely wrong, and the Labour Party was set up in the first place in the 1900s to resist that kind of attitude. And they started off with one or two MPs, you know, and they had to go from there.
Can I, Martin, make a point of what you do, when you were talking about the homeless people not getting involved in the political process? I live in a van and have done for quite a long time. I'm sort of my kind of tag, I suppose, or my social group is a bit more a traveller than anything else. But I actually ran for mayor of Bristol from a no fixed abode. You know, I ran as no fixed abode. I was the first person in this country who's actually run for a position of government with no address.
Was there any problem about that?
There was a little bit of, is he allowed to do that? Isn't he allowed to do that? And I kind of held my ground with it on one score, and on the other side of it, I would say that actually the council in Bristol is quite a cool council overall. They were really quite accommodating, actually. It was that, you know, that is Bristol's an unusual city. It's
how do you find it though? I mean, if you're living in a vehicle, do you ever find yourself just settling down to sleep for the evening and then bang 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 on the door?
No, not really. I find that most people are quite happy with it. You know, I mean, it's not ideal. I do spend a lot of time outside of Bristol. I've got a caravan on a piece of land outside Bristol as well, which is I use for writing. But when I'm in Bristol, I just haven't got the money to get paid. I haven't got the type of money that it costs to rent a place and be a writer at the same time without running around all the time working when writing is my work, and it just doesn't pay that well. And I have to take responsibility of that, and I don't really want to throw that onto the state if I'm not earning a load of money, and I don't want all the complications of it.
Martin,
can I just say what we really should be pushing for, and the Greens have been talking about this for years, and Milton Friedman, the right-wing economist in the US, originally thought of the idea, which he called negative income tax, is a citizen's income. I don't know if you remember the crass song from the 1980s, the anarchists. Do they owe us a living? Of course they do. Of course they do. Do they owe us a living? Of course they do. And what this crisis brings home, everybody in this country is entitled to a basic living, whether they work or not. And ultimately, that is where we're going to have to go to resolve the crisis.
Okay.
We're going to look after everybody. And, of course, they can work on top of that as well. It actually flexibilises the labour market.
Yeah.
So instead of losing benefit when you go to work, you will have your benefit and you work on top of that if you can find
it. OK, Martin, I'm going to close you down there because we're getting on to the other end of the scale. The petrol price has been being rigged for a decade. Motorists have paid thousands of pounds too much for their petrol over the last decade, after two of Britain's biggest companies were raided on suspicions of manipulating oil prices. Well, actually, we've covered this on this show several times already. It's a kind of LIBOR-style fixing of both petrol prices, which has apparently been going on for about a decade, possibly longer, and also a similar kind of system with gas prices. MPs and energy experts raise fears motorists have been taken for a very expensive ride after officials searched the offices of BP and Shell for evidence of price rigging. The companies are suspected of distorting the oil price since 2002, meaning drivers have been ripped off for more than 10 years. Over that time, petrol prices have risen dramatically by more than 80%. Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is how real markets in the real world really work. The free market stuff, is everybody's in competition with everybody else, and the most efficient solution is found, and profits are made because everybody's behaving properly, and you know, that's the system. This is the real world. Behind the scenes, a lot of the stuff is rigged.
So how much of that 80 pence a litre is being some kind of price fixed upwards rather than it being any kind of market price compared to, say, what you know, oil actually costs to get out of the ground?
Well, yeah, but don't forget, oil coming out of the ground is controlled indirectly by the Organisation of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Countries are allowed to get together to fix prices. So that's before we even start. Yeah. So in actual fact, the real world, and look at the fixing the LIBOR rate, that is one of the key prices in the international economy. And it turns out it's been fixed all along. Now, if things are being fixed like this behind the scenes, we haven't got a free market economy, have we? What we've actually got is a rigged system, rigged in favour of the powerful forces at the centre of the system, that is to say, the wealthy classes, are rigging the whole thing to keep themselves wealthy. If the state hadn't stepped in and bailed out the market in 2008, the whole system would have gone down the tubes, and it probably will go down the tubes in the near future anyway. And that means that there isn't a free market, it's a fantasy. And everybody's talking as if there is, there isn't, hasn't been, there never was.
Before we hear from Dave on petrol price fixing, which I imagine, if he lives in a vehicle, is one of his major outgoings, let's go to the Commons on Wednesday, where they talked about this petrol fixing scandal. Robert Halfin is the Conservative. You're here then, followed by Caroline Flint, who's Labour.
A national scandal with the oil companies concerned, and that the government should look at changing the law and put people in prison for fixing oil prices, because this has caused misery for millions of motorists up and down the country.
No amount of tariff simplification or sorting out retail at the pump actually is going to deal with the problem we're facing today, which is allegations in the way in which energy and petrol is bought and sold and the way that market works.
Doesn't look as if anyone is going to go to jail about this, and I don't know how worried they are. But Dave, what's your thoughts about this revelation that for many motorists, I mean, we're talking about thousands of pounds they have spent, which they needn't have spent, which those oil companies have robbed from them.
Well, the thing is that there is not, I don't suspect there is one person out there listening now that is in the slightest bit surprised by that. Not one. I mean, everyone who's sitting there in their cars, just driving along, is just, you know, every time you hear a new story, they're battening up, at the media, sort of telling us about a new war starting up, and the sort of like the whole fear generated through the stock market to keep the money moving, to keep the shares moving from one place to the other. It's all market fixing on every level. The fact that the big oil companies would actually sort of like sit together and try and get us to pay more is so not surprising.
Well, actually, the supermarkets probably sit down with their petrol stations at the supermarkets too. Martin, anyway, what can we do about this? Lock people up?
Well, ultimately, yes. I mean, if people break the law, we're going to send rioters to prison for two years for stealing a bottle of water. What do we do when we catch people doing this? And ultimately, that is a solution to a lot of things, because if, for example, if all the fraud in the financial markets was properly prosecuted, the money you would get through seizing the assets of the people who'd done the frauds would cover the deficit no problem, and that all we'd have to pay is their prison costs of keeping them in prison.
Well, you don't just have to pay for petrol, you have to obviously pay for your car, but there's some more money that you may be having to pay soon, and that is Bristol's congestion charge. The Bristol Post has been canvassing Bristol's MPs. Charlotte Leslie says, I think until we have a fully developed and integrated railway infrastructure and public transport, a congestion charge would be unfair. Bristol West MP Stephen Williams says, if you introduce extra costs on the people who want to come into the city centre to do their shopping or go into the city to work, of course the City of Bristol is a major employment centre, I think you will drive visitors and tourists away. Bristol East MP Labour Kerry McCarthy said, there's a real need to reduce road traffic, which is notorious for congestion, but introducing a congestion charge without getting a decent public transport system in place is putting the cart before the horse. Dawn Primarolo, Bristol South Labour, says we need further details about this from the Mayor. Martin, is it going to happen, do you think?
Well, as you can see, everybody's hedging their bets here. I mean, we all want...
Well, no, they're all really saying no, aren't they? Hmm. Pretty much.
I suppose that's what it boils down to. Because they know, without having a public transport infrastructure that people can trust... I mean, of course, the congestion charge might give you the resources to invest in a public transport infrastructure that people can trust. I mean, a lot of the problems we've got are because of decisions that were taken in the past, during the Thatcher era and during the New Labour era. And, where was the integrated transport policy that Blair and Prescott promised when they first came to power? Well, they were got at by the road lobby, by the oil companies, and by the usual suspects, and nothing came of it. And that's a constant problem.
Dave, as someone that obviously drives around the city from time to time with your, like a snail, with your house on your back.
Literally like a snail, my truck is so slow. But it's,
Is it, would you pay a congestion charge?
I don't really.
I mean, you probably have to, wouldn't you?
Well, if I had to, I probably would do, but
you might protest against it.
I think I've done it, I think in my whole time since the congestion charge came in London, I think I might have paid it once or twice. I might have taken my van into London once or twice, into the point where the congestion charge occurs. But the... I mean, I kind of think it is in the centre of the cities. I think it's a great idea, but actually, I don't see loads of traffic actually in the centre of Bristol anyway. I see all the traffic, at rush hours, sort of like going round the sort of like the main road. So, I don't think it's really necessary. I think it's just another money-making thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Capita will probably run it, and Bristol City Council might get a few bob, but Capita will make a mint. Anyway, bedroom tax has been blamed for grandmother's suicide. A grandmother who killed herself left a note in which she blamed the government for her death just days before she died. Stephanie Bottrell, 53, from Solihull in the West Midlands, told neighbours she simply could not afford to live anymore. Her family told the Sunday People she was tortured about how she would afford the £20 extra a week for the two under-occupied bedrooms in her home, money she owed because the government's spare room subsidy policy, so-called bedroom tax. Mrs. Bottrell died in the early hours of 4th of May, that's last week. Dave?
Well, I mean, it's heartbreaking, isn't it, to think that all these cuts are actually having a direct effect on people. And the reality is, it's not just the bedroom cuts, it's just cuts on every side are coming in. But what we have to think about, because I can see that my time's coming up quite soon, is it's nearly 6 o'clock, so I'd just like to say, with the cuts and everything else like that, is to remember where your money's going. Why are they cutting it? Are they cutting money because we're running out, or are they cutting money because they are funding a legal war? I believe they're funding a legal war. And so this woman, she's crying. She's committed suicide, as much because of the bedroom cuts, but also probably because she knows where that money is going to be intended to go. It's going to go on war. You know, David Cameron's doing everything he can, possibly. Even after Israel just dropped two Hiroshima-sized, supposedly clean bombs on Syria, completely illegally, David Cameron's completely supporting that whole move where, well, we don't know how many thousands of people have died in with those two massive bombs, completely illegal, and David Cameron's completely behind it, and he's spending all this money that's being generated through these cuts on illegal war in these countries. And that's what this is about. That's what this is all about. And that's what we've all got to stand up against, these cuts on every level.
Okay, standing up a little bit on Wednesday in the House of Lords for the bedroom tax. You'll hear First Lady Quinn from Labour and Lord Freud, who's the architect of this entire policy, who is, of course, a Conservative Lord.
There is mounting evidence, not only of financial hardship, but also of families and individuals coming under severe emotional pressure. And last week there was a particularly sad case reported where a tragic outcome had resulted. Mm. It seems that the warnings of many noble lords during our earlier debates on this subject are being borne out.
We are keeping a very close eye on it, because the design of this is to make sure that there are responses that people can make in terms of either trading down, pulling in lodgers, looking for work. There's a behavioural response here that we're looking for people to make, but clearly we are looking for that response.
Yeah, that was Lord Freud there. Martin, what can people do if they're worried about this bedroom tax? Certainly, don't get into despair. What can people do?
Well, as you've said on previous shows, Tony, if you're in debt and you go to court, it's unlikely that a court will evict you. So a lot of this is bluff. The fact of the matter is, as Dave's pointed out, a lot of these cuts are extremely... They're killing people. I mean, there's a study that's just come out, I read about it this week, that shows that Greece used to have the lowest suicide rate in Europe, and since the crisis began, it's gone up by 60%. And people all over Europe, all over the world, are giving up. And of course, a lot of this stuff, the bedroom tax isn't going to save any money. A lot of this is what Lord Freud is saying there. What we're looking for is a change in their behaviour, and this just shows how far away they are from the people who are being affected by this. He imagined that somebody can get a job, or perhaps they could take in a lodger, perhaps we could all take in each other's washing, perhaps Lord Freud could take in somebody else's washing, perhaps he could actually try and live on 53 quid a week himself. But I mean, you see how vicious this is. Instead of talking about the macroeconomic failure of the government, the fact that their policy is way out to sea, they haven't controlled the deficit, the economy's on the edge of a cliff, we talk about whether people with one extra room in their house can be made to take in a lodger. And it's Charles Dickens would recognise what's going on here. It's blaming the victim by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in the country.
And on to our next story. Water cannons are on standby for summer riots. The German-made water cannons are to be approved for use in mainland Britain within weeks, according to the Sunday Express. Home Secretary Theresa May is in favour of their deployment by police for the first time outside Northern Ireland amid fears of summer riots. Both the Met and ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers, have requested them to tackle any civil unrest caused by welfare cuts and June's G8 meeting of world leaders. The Ziegler Wasserwerfer 9000 is capable of carrying up to 9,000 litres of water. I'm not sure how many pints that is, or gallons, but anyway, 9,000 litres, or even tear gas, which can be fired at rioters at the powerful rate of 1,100 litres per second. Well, I mean, if you look at that, it lasts about 8 seconds, an 8-second blast, and it's gone. So, anyway, Martin, the Ziegler Wasserwerfer, what do you make of this?
Well, listen, I mean, if you're going to pursue a policy of class war from the top and persecuting the people at the bottom of the pile, some people are going to commit suicide, and some young lads with testosterone running through their systems are going to take a different line, aren't they? And you could easily see a round of rioting like in 1981 or a couple of years ago kicking off. And of course, you know, the answer to, as people in Belfast will tell you, the answer to water cannon is petrol bombs followed by car bombs, isn't it?
Dave?
To be honest with you, I'm seeing this whole back to Syria again, because that's the big thing that's coming up. A country that is not invading anyone, that we've suddenly decided that they're not actually getting involved in sort of like a in um in the main banking cartels. They're trying to break away from the US dollar. They've got to be stopped in the eyes of in the eyes of the West. They've got to be stopped. And we know that this is all building up for a summer campaign. They're trying to get everything in place, and they know there's going to be serious opposition, and they're getting the water cannons ready, aren't they?
Well, I mean, yeah, but what you've actually got is British and US special forces training the freedom fighters, or whatever you want to call them, inside Syria. And, of course, therefore, the British government is directly involved in fighting in Syria. Now, the Syrians aren't going to do this because they ain't stupid, but what would stop them saying, well, if you're going to plant car bombs in Damascus, here's one in Bristol, see how you like it? Now, I'm not saying they're going to do that. But you can see that the Syrian Arab army might be considering that. If you're going to put SAS boys in to plant bombs around Damascus, well, we could send somebody to plant bombs where you live. See how you like that? It's what the IRA used to call taking the war to the Brits. And the problem with the British is they want to go to war in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Indonesia, all over the world, and then we want to come home and have a nice cup of tea. Well, never mind, eh?
Okay, well, from
true, man.
Actually, we're sticking with the Middle East, actually, with this story. First Poundbury, now Bahrain. It's our last story. Should Prince Charles really be selling town planning to despots? A deal worth £700,000 has been signed with the Bahraini regime. Charles has been accused of using excessive force against... the Bahraini regime using excessive forces against pro-democracy activists. The Prince's Foundation for Building Community signed a £700,000 agreement with the Bahraini government to advise on sustainable housing development.
Well, if you've got the British government backing the Bahraini government, which has no support from the Bahraini people, if I was a young Bahraini patriot, I would say, just as the Syrian patriots are saying, this government is evil.
This is Prince Charles.
No, I'm just talking about the Bahraini government.
Not the British.
The Bahraini government is exactly the same as the Syrian government. The Syrian government's probably got more popular support than the Bahraini government. But Britain is supporting rebels who plant car bombs in Syria. The Bahrainis have generally been peaceful so far, but if they were to decide to plant car bombs, the obvious place to plant one is Poundbury, isn't it?
Dave, what about this deal that Prince Charles is doing with the Bahraini regime, which they are, for example, they've arrested loads of people for criticising their king on Twitter this week.
It's as Martin says, exactly that. I mean, Martin just said it far better than I can actually say. In actual fact, your anger there that came up there, it felt totally in the centre of my heart, because I I've got a lot of respect. You know, looking at Syria, we see the fact that even though it's not Bahrain, but Syria, I don't know a lot about the Bahrainian government,
okay,
but I do know.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Dave, because it's time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. After the news, a bit of Bristol transport, and also looking at this forthcoming Bilderberg conference.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, new suspects have been identified by detectives reviewing the Madeleine McCann case. Scotland Yard have a list of people of interest who they want to talk to in connection with her disappearance. Speaking earlier this month, her dad, Jerry McCann, said she felt progress was being made.
In some respects, because there was so much information, I get the feeling that the Met now feel that they're really just getting their teeth into it, and they can see all these lines of inquiry that need followed up.
An explosive device has been found by detectives investigating an attempt to murder three police officers on the outskirts of West Belfast. Follow-up searches took place following a gun attack yesterday. The jury in the April Jones murder trials heard how the accused described to police his version of what happened. Transcripts of Mark Bridger's interviews with detectives have been read out in court. He claims he accidentally knocked down the 5-year-old but didn't murder her. Coronation Street's Michael Lavelle has denied a series of child sex offences in court. The actor answered not guilty 19 times as each of the individual charges were put to him at Manchester Crown Court. Trade unions are criticising a report that says fire services in England could save £200 million a year if they operated more efficiently. The review says there's been a 40% reduction in incidents in the last decade, yet spending and staff levels have remained broadly the same. John McGee is from the Fire Brigades Union.
Last year, we still rescued over 2,500 casualties in England. Now, these casualties will turn into fatalities if the time it takes for firefighters to get there is extended any further.
And in football, the date and venue have been confirmed for a Premier League third place playoff, should it be needed. The fixture would be required if Chelsea and Arsenal end the season with identical points.